Welcome to our Holden Village podcast. For over 50 years now, Holden Village has traveled a rich history of faith that has transformed a copper mining town into a vibrant place of education, programming, and worship. Holden has sought to welcome all who seek contemplation and community in the remote wilderness of the beautiful Cascade Mountains. We continue to invite people of all ages to come alongside our rhythms, which inspire and equip travelers for a sustainable life of faith outside the village. And we continue to listen and reflect on our story and history and seek to discover our place in God's creative mission in our world. Our podcasts are a way of sharing our conversations with our teaching faculty around reformation, the reforming of our relationships with the earth, with each other, and with the divine. Let's tune in and join the conversation.
Hello, I'm Scott Harbin. I'm one of the third week of June visiting faculty here at Holden Village, and I am joined by Dr. Molly Secor-Turner, my longtime friend and colleague. And we built our careers working to improve adolescent health and well-being, mostly in the upper Midwest, but we'll talk a bit about our transitions in locations. We're here at Holden this week to collaboratively present three sessions on healthy youth development, resiliency, and adolescent social justice. In today's Holden Village podcast, we're going to try something new in terms of interview format. We've agreed to interview one another to give you, the listeners, perhaps a deeper dive into the really fascinating and fulfilling projects that we are working on in our own communities, both locally and globally. You can read our bios on the Holden Teaching website. Molly, thanks for joining this chat today.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
So, Molly, let's start off by having you tell the listeners briefly about your background and what brought you to where you are today as a champion of teens, especially girls and young women's well-being. Okay. Young women's well-being.
So I currently am an associate professor of nursing and public health at North Dakota State University in Fargo, North Dakota. I actually grew up in Fargo, so lived there the first 17 years of my life, and then moved away from Fargo to attend school and live in different parts of the United States. I landed at the University of Minnesota and completed my undergraduate nursing degree there, as well as my master's degree in public health nursing and a PhD in nursing focused on adolescent health. During that time, I worked as a labor and delivery nurse at North Memorial Hospital in North Minneapolis, and that's where my interest in adolescent health really was found its beginning. That was because that area of Minneapolis had a really high teen birth rate, and so I became really interested in what was nationally happening to prevent teen pregnancy and how it didn't really fit with what I was seeing happening on the north side of Minneapolis and the experience of young girls getting pregnant at early ages. And I also became really interested in the fact of the idea of preventing teen pregnancy happening outside of the hospital, and so really kind of started thinking about how do we prevent this instead of just addressing it when it happens in hospitals. So became interested in public health and then shifted into thinking about adolescent health and have kind of run along with that for the last years of my career.
Very cool.
Okay, how about you, Scott? How did you end up where you are today?
Well, it was kind of serendipitous, I guess. I grew up in southwest Wisconsin in the rural southwest corner of the state. Pretty typical middle-class rural America upbringing. Moved to Madison, then the Twin Cities, and kind of my second nursing job was with kids who were in foster care, who were going into foster care and then living kind of in residential treatment and shelter spaces. And that's where I really began to see kind of how upstream thinking and trying to keep kids and families healthy from a prevention standpoint could be really a best bet in how their trajectories of health, wellness, and really kind of living their lives would come to pass. So that's when I joined our graduate program in adolescent nursing and public health at the University of Minnesota. And yeah, I had a really incredible 12-year career there, and then we did our PhDs together, Molly, and really that's kind of, I think just the little kids who were in foster care and also the adolescents who were at that agency in South Minneapolis really just kind of piqued my interest in making that my career choice.
All right, so we started, as you mentioned, our graduate work together at the University of Minnesota around 2002. Mm-hmm. Since that time, what things about adolescent health and well-being have changed in the past 15 years, and are there some things that have stayed the same?
Yeah, I think like most of the stuff that you know we saw in the early 2000s has been the same in terms of what kids need to, you know, feel connected to their parents, other adults, community resources. I think we, you know that they want to have a purpose in their communities. They want to have a future and hope in what they're doing. They also want a peer network, and I think one of the things that pretty much has dramatically changed since we did graduate school was, again, like the social connection, the social networking connection, usually by, you know, first by Facebook and kind of social networking sites on the internet, and now by cell phones. You know, they've been so ubiquitous in teens' upbringing now. and I think that's kind of been one of the things that we've seen a lot over the last 15 years is how we need to either develop interventions or parent or kind of be thoughtful about how we're working with our young people and how they use their cell phones and social network and connect with their friends, because we know a lot how mental health is affected by some of the social media use. In some cases, we know how you know, bullying can occur. You hear a lot of anecdotes about that, and we still don't know from a research standpoint specifics, but we need to. That's one of the things I think that we have to do as researchers in adolescent health to take a deeper dive. But I'd love to hear that same answer from you, unless you haven't thought about that.
I think I would agree. A lot of it has stayed the same. The foundational things that we really came to fruition to, you know, continue to say these are the things young people need to turn into healthy adults, I think remain the same today. But my whole way of looking at adolescent health is always thinking about context. So I think, like you mentioned, the context is really different thinking about adolescent health today in terms of just exposure and accessibility to different risk things. So, for example, for me, who spends a lot of time in the world of sexual health, you know, young people's access to pornography today is much different than it was 10, 15 years ago. And thinking about how does that impact their sense of sexual identity and sexual health and kind of views about what sexual relationships look like today. So I think there are some changes, but those foundations of what young people need and what families and communities need to help raise healthy adolescents into healthy adults is the same.
Yeah, that's cool. So if I didn't make it clear to the listeners, we've known each other since, well, for the last 15, 16, 17 years, and we've kind of did our graduate programs together. So it's been so amazing to kind of see your career trajectory over that time, especially the last eight or 9 years since we both left the Twin Cities. So I think it was really remarkable to me when you moved away from Minneapolis to go back home to Fargo, just really how seamless it was for you to kind of fall back into kind of more rural setting, even though Fargo is a bigger town. But I know some of your first projects were doing like rural health surveys of like kids across North Dakota, and you were doing some projects in South Dakota as well. So I think one of the topics that we were talking about this week at Holden is really kind of what the health needs of urban adolescents, suburban adolescents, and rural adolescents, and how they're like similar and different. So I guess, you know, would you agree that there's a lot more similarities than not in how adolescent development happens in by geography, or kind of what you've learned over the last, you know, 8 years being back in North Dakota?
Yeah, so I think that the answer is kind of the same as the last question, that we know adolescent development and the needs that adolescents have during their path from adolescence to adulthood is pretty similar, and that those are based on just general child development needs. But the context does really make a big difference. So, you know, some of the contextual issues that were very prevalent and prominent in the Twin Cities are a little bit different than what we saw as high needs for rural youth. So, for example, in the frontier counties of North Dakota, there is very little access for young people to confidential and even private health services. So that means accessing things like birth control or accessing treatment for sexually transmitted infections, accessing treatment for even mental health concerns is a little bit more challenging in those remote settings. One, just based on geography, because some of those clinics might not be available for 100 miles or more. And secondly, because those tend to be a little bit smaller towns, so it's quite likely that a young person's aunt or neighbor might be working at the pharmacy when they go to pick up a prescription. So some of those contextual issues made a difference for the young people in places in rural North Dakota. I would say the other big issue in a state like North Dakota is the political climate is very different than particularly the Twin Cities area of Minnesota. So I've learned a lot about advocating and working with policy and thinking about how do we still create supportive environments for young people in terms of meeting their sexual health needs in particular, that we sometimes have to do that in a little bit different way than we might do in a place like the Twin Cities, where comprehensive sexuality education programs and interventions could be done in schools. It's not something we can do in the state of North Dakota. So I think while there's a lot of similarities, there's a real need to be more creative in a place like North Dakota and in working in rural settings.
Yeah, that's thoughtful.
So as you mentioned, we both left our academic cradle at the University of Minnesota about 8 years ago and moved to new communities and academic settings. You've kind of shifted your work from working with foster care youth, as you were mentioning, in Minneapolis to working with runaway and homeless youth and youth involved in human trafficking in the Denver metro area. What has that shift been like for you, and how has your work advocating for these groups of youth been similar or different?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. I kind of look at as a career shift that I think a lot of folks who finish up their PhD and move into an academic role kind of go through, and especially for you and I and others who are like clinicians and healthcare providers in the earlier part of our career, I think that's kind of also played into this natural shift where I was a public health nurse, you know, while we were in Minneapolis until we finished our PhDs, and then we're kind of like thrust into this academic world and kind of have to leave some of that clinician role behind, which kind of you have to go through a bit of a mourning process, especially if that's what drew us into the profession in the first place. But ironically, I think if you kind of look at the trajectory of the youth populations that I've been working with, they're all pretty similar. I mean, they're vulnerable kids. They come from a variety of family backgrounds and social determinants of health. So it was really quite seamless to kind of pick up and learn more, well, about the foster care system in Denver, especially because, like, you know, the systems of care are so well set up in Minnesota and respected really quite nationally. You know, so the kids I was seeing in the homeless shelter were the 17, 18, 19, 20-year-olds who were in foster care 5 years ago, you know, and you know, I think I met a kid who was in the foster care system in Minneapolis while I would have been working there. And it was just when I was in Denver in the homeless shelter. And it was just kind of remarkable to think, like, trajectory-wise, how that went down. And the health needs are the same, except, you know, the age. You have to kind of think about the age segment of where a teen is and kind of and where they are in living as independent kid, you know, at young adults and where they're at. You know, and then the recent transition to working in human trafficking prevention is kind of, you know, came from some of the research and the stuff I've learned from the runaway homeless youth, you know, 6, 7, 8 years ago. You know, and I think that's a natural progression, again, in our academic and research lives where we kind of, like, shift topics a little bit and, you know, aren't necessarily experts for our whole entire career in, like, one little bucket of what the population is we work with. And that's become a big need in Colorado. We're kind of at the crossroads of some major highways, so trafficking happens. And for me personally, it was like it's been really cool to learn a new topic and kind of become immersed in something that I don't know a whole lot about. And there's not a whole lot of research and evidence out there about this kind of underbelly of you know, risky, you know, both trafficking because it, you know, it's like a legal thing. And adding in the healthcare services has been really kind of cool and unique, not just for me, but for the legal folks and the cops and everybody that I've been working with. And advocacy kind of follows the same bucket of interests as well. Mm-hmm. So finally, Molly, here we're talking this week, and our sessions are about healthy youth development and kind of giving the foundations of what that means, adding in kind of resiliency. Framework for folks who want to learn that. But our last session is going to be about social justice, communication theory, how we can both like partner with young people to tell their stories, but also what we can do as adults who care a lot about kids, kind of advocate for them on their behalf. And a lot of community-based programs are supporting youth well-being in that way. And we're going to be talking about components of healthy youth development. So people are always wondering what the best bet is that they would invest in to get the biggest bang for their buck. So if you were to give advice on what the special secret sauce is for a perfect or for a great public health program or community-based program for teens, what would you suggest to somebody who wanted to ask you that?
So I think, we've talked about several kind of areas that affect the health of adolescents. So we talked about sexual health, we talked about foster care youth, we've talked about human trafficking. And I think one of the coolest things about adolescent health, and one of the reasons why I love working in a public health way with adolescents, is that we talk a lot about risk and protective factors for young people. So thinking about what are the things that place young people at risk for negative health outcomes, but also knowing that there are protective factors that we can help young people access or bolster for them, that when those things are present, even if the risks are there, they still have a good chance of positive health outcomes. And what's cool about adolescent health is those protective and risk factors for a whole host of issues that might affect adolescents are shared. So you have the best bet of just focusing on building assets and protective factors for young people. So even if you're working on trying to prevent teen pregnancy and you think, okay, my protective factors, I'm going to connect them to adults. I'm going to give them purpose in their community. I'm going to give them maybe help at school. Those protective factors don't just prevent teen pregnancy. They also prevent violence. They also help young people stay engaged in school. They also help young people learn how to communicate with adults. So they're all things that, mm-hmm. you know, can reduce risks that aren't just the one that you're working on.
Right.
And so I think really thinking about that prevention standpoint and focusing on those protective factors and building supportive environments for youth has an unlimited amount of potential for creating healthy places and healthy development for young people. So I think that's what's really cool about working in adolescent health. How about you, Scott? What's your secret sauce for building strong community programs for youth?
When we were preparing for this, we didn't talk about what our answers are going to be. And, like, ironically, mine is, like, super similar. I mean, I think about an individual kid and the connections. I mean, especially with my foster care and kind of runaway homeless youth work, helping kids while they're in middle adolescence, you know, like 12 to 16 years old, really identify and kind of glom on to, you know, adults in their lives who really care a lot about them, and helping them identify who their support network is, whether that be a biological parent or an adoptive parent or a foster care parent or just another adult in their lives. I really saw that as invaluable when I worked in foster care, and that was one of the biggest assessment questions that I had. And then I guess more globally, it's just really economic well-being of a community and just, like, again, programs in a community that would, like, support, you know, youth development and kind of that ethos, which we're going to talk about in our talk tomorrow. But if there's, like, no hope for a kid in their community for what they're going to do, you know, when they're an older adolescent or a young adult, that's the secret sauce we need to figure out, I think, is kind of what the community and what the adults in the community are going to do to help support kids as they're growing up.
Okay. Well, thanks for chatting about adolescent health today, Scott.
Yeah. Thank you, Holden Village podcast listeners, for listening to us, and we'll look forward to hearing from you soon.
Thanks for joining us for another Holden Village podcast. Be sure to view the links in the description for more information, or visit our website to find out more about the village. We hope you will make a pilgrimage to Holden. Blessings and peace to you.